Hello, and thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to all those who are tuning in every couple of weeks to listen. Keep coming back because we've got lots of very different subjects to explore over the next few months. But if this is your first time listening, glad to have you here. Welcome. And thanks to everyone for their continued support. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues, why should you have all the fun? These podcasts will tackle many different topics. So if there is an issue you think we should pursue, or if you have questions and comments on what we've already covered, please let us know. Contact details are on the Audio Boom page, where every episode is now available. Take the afternoon off, listen to, I know, 10, 20 in a row. This episode is tackling a subject that is already throwing a dark shadow over the industry and will continue to do that for probably forever, I would imagine. And that topic is AI and machine learning. It's a topic that deserves a thorough working over because of its potential for, I was going to say driving change, but I'm not sure if it's driving change or wreaking havoc, one or the other. And I'm sure it's a subject we'll return to in future podcasts. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF and have spent the last few months researching this topic. But to be honest, I'm not sure I feel like I know a huge amount more than I did when I started. I know some things, but it's changing so fast that I'm sure that knowledge is going to get shown up, worn out quite soon. But I'm not alone to talk about this topic. Also here is Patricia Rodriguez, someone who has just started a career in information security. She's now a cloud security engineer after doing a master's in information security. And before that, worked on a project to move an in-house application to a cloud platform. Hello, Patricia.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. I saw that you described one of your interests as any mind-bending concept. So just to throw you a bit of a curveball at you, does AI bend your mind? Is that one of those topics?
It does. Anything that would stop me for a while and make me think on what's happening there. I actually, when I wrote that, I meant more quantum physics things, but definitely AI now and large language models do fit it into that one-liner.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think as soon as you spend any time thinking about that, then the complications and complexities really start to bend your mind, definitely. Also here is regular guest Paul Watts, hope he doesn't mind me calling him that, who's a distinguished analyst at the ISF, a former CISO, and is also the proud owner and operator of his own AI engine. Hello, Paul.
I wouldn't go that far. Certainly not mine. Maybe borrowed a little bit of it. And anyway, we don't need to worry because, you know, as Bill Gates famously said about the internet, this AI stuff will never catch on. It's just a fad. Yeah, we'll get over it and move on at some point. I should also say congratulations, Patricia, and you've made a fantastic choice joining the wonderful world of information and cybersecurity. Welcome to the club.
Thank you. Very excited to be here.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be a harrowing ride.
It's going to be a bumpy ride, definitely. Yeah. Well, that's why people join it. It's different every day.
In a good way.
But just to talk a little bit about some of the work I've been doing on the AI and machine learning. The research paper is out in late June. So if you're listening after that, by all means, go and download it from ISF Live. But that paper is mainly about operational machine learning, which is those usually pretty big systems that are used to automate or streamline some kind of internal process or function. We've seen ISF members use it for predictive maintenance, drug discovery, analyzing, classifying customer behavior, that kind of thing. But also the paper does deal with ChatGPT, which is one of those things we're going to talk about now. There's an appendix that deals with that, and decided to tackle that because the topic came up. ChatGPT just has blown up over the last few months. It's excited some debate amongst members, if that's the words. I don't know, Patricia, in your organization, it's a lot of chatter about it, a lot of people wondering, worried, just curious about it. So what's being done with it?
In my previous organization, yes, there was some movement around it, some discussion starting to be held, mostly how can this help us improving our service to the customers. And I feel like eventually every organization will ponder that and will see that as an option.
Yeah, I think a lot of them are going through that already. We've done a couple of workshops, roundtable discussions with organizations, looking at it. And it's interesting what you say, sort of people saying how they can it can help them, because a lot of the discussions have been, how can we stop it? It seems to be doing bad things. I don't know, Paul, but Paul, from your experience as a CISO, is it just like any other technology that it, you know, it has good sides, bad sides?
It will be like any technology where the business finds a way to start playing around with it and fiddling with it. And then something will go bang and there'll be a silent scream somewhere in the corner of the business. And someone would appear with a box of broken things and said, oh, I think we might broken something. Can you help? And the CISO will say, whoa, what have you been doing? Well, the internet said it was okay. Right. And they won't stop and tell me what you've just done. And then we have to take the shift right, the organization running off into the distance and try and understand what it is that they're trying to do. That's a day in the life of any CISO dealing with a modern business trying to get a jump on their competitors. And like back to your point earlier, Mark, that's why every day is a school day in cybersecurity. There you go. That's your first life lesson, Patricia. Every day is a school day in cyber.
Indeed.
Rinse and repeat.
Yeah, and I do think that at least the first few instances that we see that happening is because people generally want to do a good job. They want to provide that excellent outcome. So they'll just use tools like this. And they're really a bit gullible. They will take anything that is believable and that can introduce bad things for the organizations that then the CISO will have to deal with.
Yeah, yeah, we're definitely at the point of, ooh, look at it. It's the gosh wow phase of it all, isn't it? I think the I've having done this research project, I'm definitely in the trough of disillusionment. I've definitely gone past the it's the greatest thing ever to the yeah, but is it though? And what is it really going to do for us? Because I've seen, you know, I think some shortfalls it has, and it can properly harnessed, but I don't think anyone's done that yet. Properly harnessed, it can make a difference, and there are some uses of it that really do worry me.
Well, let's be honest about it, Mark, right? You know, everybody knew this stuff was being incubated in the background, and then we were waiting to see who was going to blink first, and open.ai, can't even say it, open.ai blinked first, and dropped ChatGPT into a world as an answer, looking for a question, and you know, that's exactly what we did with it, and you know, there's a huge amount of excitement. And the idea of just trying to find the proverbial question with which to use to answer. And, you know, I think we've kind of gone past that initial excitement and it's kind of out there and we've seen it do good things. We've seen it do bad things. I mean, if you give it a sob story that, you know, your dear departed granny used to read Windows 10 license keys to you to get you off to sleep, ChatGPT, bless its little cotton socks, will go, oh, look, you know, can't have this, dry your eyes, here's a couple of Windows 10 keys, read those and nod yourself off to sleep. So it's easy to play the game with all of this. And as with anything, you know, the good is balanced with the evil. We're going to be looking for all the ways that we can weaponize and repurpose this for bad, whilst at the same time, the goodies are all looking at the ways of trying to find the good in all of this. But I do feel, and I understand why you're in a trough of disillusionment, Mark, because I think we're kind of looking at it now going, well, it lies a little bit, it's easily distracted, it hallucinates, you know, all the things that we've prophesized would be challenges that are all now starting to surface. So, you know, like the intrigued child running into the sea and being chased out by the waves, I think as society is being chased out by the waves right now, well, we're having a little think about, you know, how we get in the sea properly with AI. And if I can find any more metaphors to chuck at you in the next 20 minutes, Mark, I will do my level best to find them.
Go for it. Yeah, I think certainly with the roundtable discussions we had, there was it was good in the sense that there were some policies, processes that are going to work with it and can help, like sort of acceptable use policies. And then there's some efforts you can do to target particular departments that where it'll cause most problems if it gets used, like legal and things like that as well. But I don't know, Patricia, for you, is there anything in ChatGPT you could do as a cloud security engineer? I don't know if you're allowed to look at it and use it, because again, a lot of organizations these days seem to be blocking or pointing people towards other ways to do the task that they're trying to set ChatGPT or similar things.
So you touch on lots of points that make me kind of say something about. In my role directly, I haven't used it because not only because if I'm working through the your organization's desktop, I wouldn't do it. But even in my own words, I've used ChatGPT to a certain level, and I went through various phases, right? And yeah, the first one was obviously, wow, this is incredible. And it does help you a lot in many ways. It can help you rewrite just a simple thing, a simple email or a simple sentence, or even to get... So one of the first things that I asked it to do was to write me some recursive code, some form of recursion. And you can take a lot of benefits from it. You stop wasting, air quotes there, time in things that you know what you want and you're just going for it. So in that sense, it's very, very useful. What I would say is that even if you're not allowed to do it in an organization, many times you will, because if it's to rewrite something or to do some piece of code that you need for your job, you might just as well just grab your phone. Anyone has a phone. Just go to ChatGPT there, to the chat box, and chat with it and ask it, and you'll get, okay, it's a bit more manual, but ultimately people will be able to do it. So it's not just because you're blocking it at the network organization level, it doesn't mean that people will not be using it. You're perhaps not letting data go out, which is already pretty good, but you always have that kind of barrier.
Yeah, there's a difficulty there, definitely, in that, yeah, trying to block it, people will still find ways around it because it's useful. I think you said that in the past, Paul, haven't you, just that it's better to work with the way people are using it and try and find out what they're trying to do and why they need it, rather than block it en masse and sort of say and slap people's wrists away from keyboards.
Yeah, I think security leadership's kind of moved away from the hands up in the air and saying no to everything, because, you know, what we've discovered over the last 10 years or so is that we've succeeded very, very well at demystifying technology. So, you know, back in the dim distant past, if you wanted to roll with a bit of tech or innovation, you generally needed to jump through the hoops of technology teams to get it there, which meant at some point you would come into contact with annoying people like me. But whereas now anybody armed with a credit card and a web browser can hire a data center in the sky, you know, this is the sort of stuff that Patricia's going to be doing in her new role. That's very, very hard to wrap your arms around and control. And the reality of it is that we've had to repurpose the way that we approach the business problem of tackling innovation. So rather than saying no, but, you know, we have to work with the business to think about what the novel and consensus use cases are and try and understand together what the pros and the cons are, and then come up with the most efficient and safe way of using that technology, learning from our mistakes, iterating that and going again. A lot of organizations, however, were so startled by how quickly and how prolific ChatGPT, Bard and others came into industry that they did need to pull a portcullis down and say, look, you know, just give us a little bit of time to really think about what the rules of the playground are before we allow you to start using this. But interestingly, talking to a lot of my colleagues in the industry, you know, when they were implementing those blockades using whatever platforms that they were using, remember what I said earlier about the screams and the small fires and people running around?
Yep.
It was happening. You know, there were business functions that were already using MML and AI technologies and chatbots, which stopped them in their tracks. And you then were back into the usual firefighting mode, which was, well, this is something the business is actively using. We need to find a way to get it back online and very, very quickly. And that just kind of amplifies the point that I made that, you know, stuff comes onto the market, innovators, the business are using it at breakneck speed. But yeah, the answer isn't always to just say no, not anymore.
I would add, just joining the what you said, Paul, and you, Mark, something that we need to be aware of, and Mark, you did mention acceptable use policies, and yep, to me, it's almost not meaningless, but if we look at it, good people follow policies. And in this kind of arms race,
that's
where
very true.
It's bad guys versus good people, and we perhaps are better off just going full steam on, okay, what other controls can we do that actually help us against those bad actors? And part of me says this because from my perspective, if it's possible, it will be done. And it's not just a deterrent control, like a policy, that can stop it.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, because I know certainly the roundtable discussions, people did acknowledge that that's a weak first step, I think, and that other things need to come in their wake. Because I think a couple of people that were on those discussions were overseeing some development pipelines, and they were worried that, yeah, sure, it can speed up some of that code generation, but it just pushes the testing and other things further down the track. And I think that's what they were worried about. So it's sort of, yeah, you suddenly there's a group moving much faster, but it just hands on the problems elsewhere. So I think it's that understanding of the whole thing. But yeah, I think you're right. There's bad guys are going to cash in, and their acceptable use policy is they don't have one. Anything's acceptable.
It's not just the bad guys. Patricia makes a fantastic point there that you also have the accidental adversary. I think the old school of being able to use policy statements as a way to deter and choreograph and cajole people into behaving in a particular way is 10-year-old thinking in most organizations. I think that whilst the policy statements are important, and ISMS frameworks and LegReg requirements mandate that those policy mandates exist, I think it's more important to have the focus on the training, education and awareness side of things, to have the right culture in the organization, but actually invest more effort in what those guardrails are. So how do I use this technology safely? It's natural human behavior. If you tell a child that they can't do something and use the language of no, I mean, all you're doing is amplifying their desire to actually go and do it. It's like me at them. I tried a little bit of running during pandemic while the gyms were shut down, and got COVID and didn't do it for a couple of months. And then tried to run again, and my knees were having none of it. And I got diagnosed with patella tendinopathy, which is proving very difficult to shift. Now all I want to do is run because I've been told that I can't, and that's the mentality that you see day in, day out in business. So, it's just not the right way to approach the problem. So it's a really great point, Patricia.
People are everything.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's that culture aspect of it is... But it's tough to do, though. I mean, it's some because those organizational things, ways of living and being, get embedded, and you're shifting that is hard. But it's definitely part of the InfoSec.
You'll never change your culture overnight, Mark. It's always going to be a long game, it is changing. It is absolutely changing. If I go back to when I was working in financial services, it was very tight and stifling and restrictive. And what we now have in the next generation of workforce coming in is much more fresh and invigorating, and the older CISOs, and I include myself in that, are the ones that have kind of had to change and recognize that we can't hide behind rules and regulations, and they need to be there, but it's how you roll with them rather than how you fight them that is the secret sauce to companies being successful. So we've had to change our ways too.
I was going to ask whether this is an age thing as well, just that as an old man, I'm quite suspicious of technology because it's changed things in all kinds of ways. But I don't know, Patricia, are you much more as a younger person, just speaking for your entire generation, if you could do that for a moment, then is it an age thing?
The young generation.
is it just you're much happier with technology? Is that it, a part of it? Or do you look at as sort of Paul and myself as the people who tried to stop you doing things, but you're like, well, if it works and it does good things, then why would
you? Yeah, choose your next words carefully, Patricia.
No, I couldn't live without technology. And I say this because my whole life, since I've actually done something on my own, it's been with technology, from phones, computers. They've always been there. And now adding this other layer, where it actually you interact, it's like almost a two-way interaction. It just adds on to it. But it definitely, I don't know a world without it. So it couldn't live without it.
Yeah, and I think it's something that I, you know, I've grappled with personally with you know, some of my older family members. This thing around computers being seen as largely authoritative, and the older generation, they simply trust what the computers spit out, whether that's on a social media platform or on a slightly more credible news wire or something else. The information is accepted without challenge.
Yeah.
And people are very easily manipulated if they see everything as authoritative sources. Now, if you think about that in the context of artificial intelligence and certainly the technology that we're rolling with at the moment. For example, I asked ChatGPT to tell me a little bit about myself, gave it a few clues. I said, tell me, you know about Paul Watts, the former CSO, now working at the ISF, yada, yada, yada. Presented a fantastic bio, got all the dates wrong. Now, I couldn't for the life of me work out how that happened. One or two things is happening. It's hallucinations, and we know that's a thing, or it's being fed duff information. And there's a fundamental thing that we have to remember, and generations that haven't rolled with technology and have that ability to critique and challenge it directly need to recognize this. You throw garbage into an MML, guess what you're going to get out the other end? Garbage. So, you know, the whole disinformation, misinformation threats that we've been dealing about with in the world of unstructured data become quite amplified in the world of AI and machine learning models. Yeah. And if you don't think about that in terms of consumers who don't necessarily have the heritage, the pedigree, or the capacity to challenge, well, that's a great way to misdirect or misinform, isn't it? So, you know, there are some things that we need to do there. But, you know, generations like Patricia, who, you know, don't know a world without technology, are going to roll with this stuff a lot easier than others.
Yeah.
And that
but
is a generational thing.
Are you a skeptical consumer, Patricia? Again, speaking for your generation, are you very, do you know that what you're being told by these tools, you have to treat with some, you have to critique them?
I not only know from experience, but I also try to tell it to everyone that I go by, because people are incredibly gullible. They can believe anything, because when you ask something to ChatGPT, you're already wanting to hear a certain answer back. And
that's very true.
It's like ChatGPT picks up on those subtle hints. And even if it doesn't know, or it is not sure or something, what do you think that is more likely to have a thumbs up from the human that is giving the feedback to the tool? I don't know, or just giving it something that is wrong, but extremely close to what an answer would be. So in the case of your dates, between saying, I don't know the date, or saying 1st of January 2022, it will say the latter.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there is that sort of, it tries to give you what you want, which I think is a dangerous thing, because it doesn't, that's not objective, and not that it necessarily has to be, but it's there's that.
Well, no, Mark, you're very keen on the concept of unpicking the challenges of unconscious bias, and I think it comes back to what Patricia said. You know, we will. I love the analogy, actually. You know, you ask ChatGPT a question, you will have an expectation of what that answer will be. We see what we want to see, and we hear what we want to hear. You know, how do you make yourself agnostic to say that, you know, I don't have any preconceived ideas or questions? I think that's really, really quite challenging. But think about the data that's being loaded into these models. What if that is biased already? You know, do you end up with a biased situation on the other side? Mark, I know you've looked at this. I don't know if you've got any initial thoughts on that, and then certainly interested in Patricia's view.
Yeah, I think there is certainly in the papers we put in some warning boxes, and absolutely the discussions I've had with members is keep an eye on the regulation, because that is absolutely in flight and will change and will get much more restrictive. It has to, because there was a great study out earlier in the week, which was from I think Stanford, which run a project to see how many of these large language models actually meet the regulations that are being drafted by the EU and all around the world, and none of them make it. So, you know, it's just sort of whatever's going to happen when those regulations are in place, all these large language models are going to have to go back and say, yeah, we're going to have to change the way that we do this. Because if anybody who, any government, regional or other that wants to start making these things behave better, is going to put huge restrictions on those tools themselves and then whatever organizations do with them. Yeah, so I think that's going to be, that's the next big step for that, for a lot of organizations. They went, oh, we've been using it and now I've got to use it in a different way. Great.
Yeah. We've been here before as well. Do both of you remember the Tay experiment back in 2016?
Yeah.
So Microsoft did an AI chatbot back in 2016 for listeners who weren't aware of this, and it was called Tay. And it was the UI was basically Twitter. So they spun up a handle, Tay and You, I think it was. And basically, Joe Public could interact with Tay as a chatbot. And it went live, I think it was March 23. It was something like that. My memory is a bit heinous, but I should have looked at this before the thing. But anyway, what was happening was very, very rapidly, Tay started behaving in a very, very odd way. So it started releasing racist and sexually charged messages to the point when it really crossed the line when it responded to a question on did the Holocaust happen, and the answer was not an answer that you would have expected. And Microsoft rapidly realized that, Twitter has got a certain type of person on it, if you're mischievous and that way inclined, you're pumping that sort of material into Tay, and Tay is learning, and he thinks that everybody behaves like that. Guess what? Tay started behaving like that, and Microsoft were in there going, "Oh my dear! Well, we've got to do something about this." It was trying to delete the tweets that Tay was giving out that were quasi-inflammatory. Tay had no moral compass. It didn't know that what it was saying was wrong, in quotes, or it was just absurd or rude or racist, or it had no way of knowing. And it got worse and worse and worse to the point where Microsoft said, something's going to go badly wrong here, and they pulled the plug. And that was the dress rehearsal, and that was 2016. Here we are in 2023, all acting a little bit surprised because we can get ChatGPT to do some crazy stuff as well. It is a Pandora's box that we have opened, and I think your point is regulation to a point, but to Patricia's point, the human is the key, and we've got to think about how we work with technologies like this, how we moderate our use, and how we learn to trust it. I just thought I'd share the Tay story with you.
I'm not sure it's improved with the large language models we see now, because I think it was, again, last week, just reading something that I think it's ChatGPT has in this, the model that was used to train that. There's 200 million copyrighted documents and images. There's hate speech, there's code, there's patents, there's all kinds of intellectual property. And if the regulators come calling, how do you justify that? If they really get strict on this, then a lot of organizations have some problems, potentially. And if that's going to get cleaned up, I don't know how. I think if GDPR and the AI regulations get rolled together, then organizations have got a real problem to sort out.
Well, that's an interesting one as well, Mark, isn't it? So and we may not be able to unpick this in this Analyst Insight podcast. It might be one for another day. But when you think about intellectual property and you think about liability, so if a chatbot commits libel, who's on the hook? On the hook for that? If ChatGPT spits out a formula which is a vaccine for whatever disease is, who owns that? And that absolutely blows my mind, And I kind of come back to hearing how U.S. Congress tackled some of the social media moguls not so long ago, and realizing there's such a significant knowledge gap with the legislators and law lords and the technologists and innovators. I really worry about the latency that we're going to have to deal with whilst legislation's catching up to speed. Again, Mark, I know you've done a bit of research on this. How do we control that?
I don't know. I'm not sure anybody does yet.
What do you mean you don't know?
Well, I think from what I can see, I mean, it's certainly true that a lot of those regulations are coalescing around the sort of similar kinds of approaches. So they want them to be fair, transparent, and accountable. But it remains to be seen what that means. And you know, good luck to any organization that's trying to justify, which are trying to sort out their own definitions for that as well. Generally as well, those regulators are looking at outcomes. So what is it doing to your customers? What is it doing to society? And I think that's where some of the regulation is going to come down. But it's a tricky place to be, I think.
I might have dreamt this, and tell me if I'm not naming no names, but I recall an incident in the insurance sector where an MML was being used and the consumers took umbrage at the insurer because the products were being biased or something like that. So I think we're kind of skirting around the potential litigious dark waters of what some of this stuff can do. Yeah. You know, who's going to be the first brave soul to step a foot over the line and see who shoots it off? I'm intrigued by that, because I mean, and it takes me back to, sorry, I'm showing my age now, and you know, back in the days of Robert Schifrin and Steve Goldman, they did the Prestel hack. They were initially tried under, I think it was the interception of the Interception of Telecommunications Act. I think they tried to get prosecuted under the Fraud Act. Basically, the government wanted to take them to task over what it was they did because it was embarrassing, yada, yada. It was famously known as the Prince Philip Prestel hack. Look it up. Robert's still very much alive and well. Sadly, Steve is no longer with us, but it's a fantastic story. But there was no legal instrument to prosecute them, and in the end, I think they got off on a technicality, and that was the start of what became the Computer Misuse Act of 1990, and that was years after. So you know, we're going to go through all this again. You know, can we shorten that now? I think, as you said earlier, it's moving so quickly that you know, as quickly as the legislation catches up, it's two generations away from that.
Yeah, I think it's
advantage. Really,
yeah, I think it will always technology move faster than the regulations can, just for very obviously. But I don't know, Patricia, just to sort of, again, as your spokesperson for your generation, if that's right, amongst engineers, I guess they like their tools and they like their, not tricks exactly, but do you feel like this is something that you're optimistic about and that you will be using in the future? That there's a definite use there for it. It's not going to be something that's just a bit of a fad.
I feel like that, definitely, because as I was saying, it is helpful for many, many things to get certain data, certain kind of answers. You did touch just now on a good point, the ethics point about biases, and that's what we need to realize. It's a tool. It doesn't have that moral compass that you're mentioning. It just runs on whatever data we give it. And I heard this, a colleague of mine said that, each person just kind of wants their own version of the tool that is aligned to their own values, to their own beliefs. And potentially, it's just the data, right? It's just the data that's underlying. And if it matches your core values, you'll be okay. For anything that is like little pieces of, write me this code or write me like this email in a nicer way or in a more professional way, I've used it, and it just gets a lot of that burden from yourself. And if you're in a rush, it's perfect. In terms of creative things, if you don't feel like being creative, you can just use it. At the same time, it then touches on the ownership of that creativity.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, where's that come from? Yeah, because I've certainly fiddled around with it myself, and there are certainly sort of obscure corners of coding that it's really useful for, because it gives you the syntax straight away, and you're like, and then you know, you're back to what you were doing initially. But I don't know. Interesting point about sort of where it might take us and the ethics of that, because I suppose engineers have to confront the ethics of using it and what that means for them as well.
The first thing that made me not happy about it, about ChatGPT in particular, was actually in a very engineering field, because I asked it exactly for something that I knew it wasn't possible. When it spat out the code for it, I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is amazing, because it's just wrong. But at the same time, it's so believable.
Yep.
So, but engineers will soon find out because you try to run the code and it's not doesn't work.
Yeah, nothing happens. Yeah, Paul, I don't know, are you optimistic about where this is taking us, or are you sort of a bit jaded and cynical like me?
I'm jaded by it at the moment because it mainstreamed relatively quickly and there was a lot of noise around it. I think as people have kind of found their way with it, we've worked out what it's good at and what it's not so good at. I think for the large majority of consumers, I don't know what the usage numbers are now, but the initial numbers for ChatGPT were absolutely crazy. And whether that's settled down or not, I honestly don't know, as people sink into that trough of disillusionment. I think for many, it's just a bit of a toy. I think for others, there's absolutely amazing opportunities for this. I just think we've got to get past that kind of trust and confidence issue that's around it. You know, not everybody is going to be an engineer that kind of already half knows what the answer might be. I like what Patricia, you said, you know, the idea that, you know, if you want to get your creative juices flowing, then, you know, a little bit of a conversation with ChatGPT is a great way to kind of unblock the old gray matter. And I absolutely subscribe to that, you know, and I wouldn't lie, there's a couple of times where I've kind of kicked a couple of ideas around on ChatGPT just to see what it said back. There's definitely some mileage in that, you know, that stimulation of creativity. But I guess there's a philosophical question that we aren't equipped to answer, which is, are we ever going to see this entity, be able to evolve into the creative mind that a human would have? And I don't think the answer is yes at the moment, because I don't think it has the ability for critical thinking. It's basically, its ideologies, its beliefs, and its ability to process are based on what the humans have pumped into them. I think when they kind of transcend that, they've got the ability to think for themselves. Well, hold my drink. I think now we're in completely uncharted territory. So I'm a little bit cynical that we are hitting those definitions of AI in terms of truly kind of sentient consciousness, but we're pretty darn close. I think if you know its limitations and you know what it's good at, you can turn it to some really useful use cases, but
it has its
beyond
uses.
That, I'm not quite there yet, personally.
No, I don't quite trust it yet. In fact, I'm going the other way. I think it's betrayed my trust too many times, too quickly for me to go, I'm very skeptical when I, but I think you're right, Patricia. Yeah, it is a good aid to just prodding you to think about some things. But as well, it's a bit pedestrian. It's yet to startle me with something in the way that some of my favorite authors do. So I think we're a long way from it being a replacement for those yet.
I mean, it was funny because everybody got excited about it, you know, it's been able to pass the bar first time. Well, of course it's going to be able to pass the bar first time. You fed the damn syllabus into it. What do you expect it to get an F? I mean, so, you know, I was looking past all of that fad and excitement thinking, just think about what you just said. I gave it a textbook and then I gave it some questions based on the textbook and it answered it eloquently. Kel surprise. Sorry, Patricia, I talked over you there. What were you going
to
say?
I just want to say to your point regarding creativity, will it ever be that creative mind? I think we are playing a lot with definitions, the definition of correctness, the definition of truth, the definition of creativity. So I think it all depends on that underlying definition how do you define it?
Because that's very true. Certainly on the history of AI is the history of moving goalposts. And you know, as soon as AI systems got good at chess, and a lot of people said, well, yeah, of course they, I mean, it's a formless system, so of course they can. And then they moved it and said, well, yeah, of course they're going to be good at that. And it just gets pushed further and further back. Yeah, I think, definitely some truth to that. But that,
I mean, Patricia does call out a little bit of an InfoSec nuance there that, again, I think is starting to leave. And it's exactly that, the ability to think differently. It's very easy for, you know, this is a sweeping generalization and I don't mean to offend anybody, but we are quite comfortable working in the confines of risk and control frameworks and policies and regulations and so on and so forth. But actually, the very definitions of some of those things do need to be challenged in the context of where the planet and society is going. And I think your point is well made, you know, maybe we need to revisit some of the definitions that we use to almost calibrate our opinions of MMLs and AI models. And I think that's, again, speaks volumes to why I'm such a fan. I think it's so important to work with the next generation of cyber professionals, because, you know, you all do think very, very differently. And I think we do need that injection of creativity and lateral thinking into the industry of cybersecurity. And this might be a great case study for how we can put that to some really good use.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely one of the conclusions of the paper I've done, is that to make good use of this, you have to give up a bit of trust and a bit of control, really. And I think that's a difficult place to be for a lot of organizations, because they're really all about maintaining control and trying to understand trust and what it does. So I think it's but we've gone through some very thorny issues there. Thank you, Patricia. Thank you, Paul, as well. Always great to have these conversations. One thing you can trust, you could trust us to entertain. So please keep coming back. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. You can now find ISEP podcasts on all major podcast platforms. If you look at the show notes for our page on Audio Boom, you can subscribe. So make sure you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available on securityforum.org, where you can learn more about ISEP research, tools, and guidance.